Hello, everybody. Welcome to a very special episode, a bonus episode. Today, we are dropping my conversation with MMA legend, UFC Hall of Famer, former UFC heavyweight champion, former Pancrase champion, Boss Rutten, the man who has his hands in pretty much every part of MMA, from color commentating to, again, fighting to coaching. I mean, he's pretty much done it all within the sport, and we are talking to him about many different topics, including his association with Strikeforce. He got to call some of their events. He coached fighters that fought inside the Hexagon. We also talk about Fedor a lot. We also talk, surprisingly, about Mike Tyson's current training for his fight with Roy Jones Jr. Boss has been there for a few of his training sessions, so we talk about where Tyson is at, how he expects that the former heavyweight champion will be looking in his fight, and what he might do afterwards. It's a great wide-ranging conversation. We talk about the importance or lack thereof of body type within MMA. There's just Bob Sapp. There's just so much we get into. So without further ado, let's get to it. All right, on the line with us, we have MMA legend Boss Rutten, former UFC heavyweight champion, UFC Hall of Famer, three-time King of Pancrase, color commentator, coach, TV analyst, former podcaster, actor. I mean, anything you don't do, Boss?
Oh, I don't know. Sexy dancing? I don't do that. Mike Perplex.
Are you a reverend yet, or like anything else that you're that you got your?
I did marry two people. You know.
There you go. There you go. On some plane, you're a reverend in some way. Yeah. So. Well, I appreciate you being on the show with us today. I want to jump right in. You had, of course, a very, very decorated career, but once you retired, you got into coaching. One of your proteges, Dwayne Bang Ludwig, he fought for Strikeforce several times. In fact, he actually headlined a card early on in the history of the promotion. What were your thoughts on Strikeforce when you heard about the new promotion? Were you familiar with Scott Coker at that time?
Yeah, I was familiar with Coker right from the beginning. I mean, all the way back, Shamrock Gracie, right? So, and that was the biggest show ever, for what I understood at the time, especially. Maybe it was even the first legal fight thing.
It was the first sanctioned MMA event in California. Of course, they had the Indian reservation fights and that sort of thing, but it was the first sanctioned event, and then it was had over 18,000 in attendance, so it set North American MMA record at that time.
Nice. Yeah, so no, I always liked it. I always liked Scott's promotion. He's just a really good promoter, and his shows were always top-notch.
Yeah, so obviously you were involved with Pride at that time. You were a commentator there, which, we're talking about Strikeforce. I used to work for Strikeforce for a while, but honestly, my all-time favorite promotion is Pride, of course. But Scott had a great relationship, still has a great relationship with major Japanese MMA executives, which is why we still see fighters from Japan fighting Bellator as well as Bellator fighters in Ryzen. We also saw Coker do Grand Prix and tournaments, which are still popular in Japan even today, and kind of some of these circus-style fights, which we just covered the Bob the Beast Sapp versus Yan the Giant Norte on the show, which was, to me, reminded me of a Pride-style type main event. Did Strikeforce remind you of Pride because of the things I just laid out? Why or why not? What similarities did you see?
Well, just crazy matchup. Yes, of course, the tournament style. I really enjoyed that. And of course, you know, once they got Fedor and Emelianenko coming in there. And then this is so weird. I mean, Fedor did so well in Pride Fighting Championships. And I think he was a little bit past his prime once he went to Strikeforce. I believe he won the first one, Brad Rogers. And then he had three losses in his row. That's where he started losing. Even Dan Henderson, the last time, I believe, it was Dan Henderson.
Correct.
So, you know, but just to bring those people over, like you said, you know, you could tell that Scott had a lot to do with fighters from Japan, and also the way he put shows together. So he was always looking for not only skilled fighters, but, you know, just known fighters and fighters who are freaks in other areas.
Yeah, he definitely would employ those. And we saw some of those fights, which sometimes they turned out well and sometimes they didn't. But you mentioned Fedor, my favorite all-time heavyweight. I mean, to me, he's the GOAT as far as heavyweights go. But you mentioned him losing to Dan Henderson. I was there the night he lost to Fabricio Verdun, which just kind of broke my heart as far as an MMA fan goes. What other Strikeforce moments stand out in your mind, whether they were good or bad, whether you were there or in person or not? Kind of what sticks out in your mind when you think of Strikeforce?
Oh man, this is so hard. We commentated a bunch on it with, at the time with HDNet, which later became Access TV.
Right.
And we did some great shows. That's why we say Daniel Cormier. We saw that for the first time. Jacare beat Lawler. Remember that? Luke Rockhold fighting Tim Kennedy at the time. He beat Tim Kennedy, and he beat. Oh, that was a tournament, I believe. Keith Jardine and Tim Kennedy. You see that, of course, Nick Diaz. I mean, what's not to like about Nick Diaz? Paul Daly. I mean, all these guys, they were freaking animals. You know, Nate Marquardt. I mean, look at him. He's been everywhere. He's been in a three-time Bankers middleweight champion also, and he became their champion as well, and he fought some great fights as well. Damian Maia, I believe, that he believed beat. Pretty much everybody, you know, all these tournament style. Overeem. I mean, Overeem coming in and doing a freaking unbelievable job. I mean, Brad Rogers ended up knocking out Paul, or stop. No, he didn't. Did he stop Paul Brantello?
Yes, Alistair stopped Paul Brantello to win the inaugural Strikeforce heavyweight title. That's right.
Yeah, see, so that was crazy. And Brantello, I always loved that guy, you know.
Big fan.
Oh, yeah, always came to fight. Doesn't matter who he's fighting. Always liked that guy. So, yeah, and Brett Rogers also. But Brett Rogers, I remember, the perfect punch that dropped him was Fedor. That was such a perfect punch. That was Strikeforce, right? Yeah, that was Strikeforce.
It was Fedor's. He fought in Affliction a couple times. He knocked out Arlovsky and Sylvia, and then he went into Strikeforce.
But the way, if you look at that fight, if you look at Beck, his hand is, you know, pretty much everybody has a little bit of a load up. Even if it's a little tiny bit, while you punch somebody, you know, you kind of load up a little tiny bit. He has zero load up in that. I mean, his hand was forward already, and then from that position, he punched, and it was so hard and so on the money that he knocked him out with one shot. That was a really great moment for me.
Let me ask you, this isn't, I wanted to ask you about this as well. This isn't really in my notes, but my co-host and I have been kind of talking about this. You brought up Buentello. We're talking about Fedor. These are two guys that don't look like, they're not body guys. You know, these aren't guys that are going to be winning any, you know, weightlifting competitions, or, you know, they don't look great from an aesthetic standpoint, but yet, especially Fedor, obviously, you know, one of the greats. And like you said, Buentello was one of the guys that always brought it and all that stuff. How much stock do you put in the way that a guy looks, you know, muscles, how cut he is, things like that? Does that matter to you at all as far as a fighter goes? Or is it just all about the performance and they can have a Roy Nelson style gut as long as they've got the gas tank and can go?
You know, there is a difference between the guys who lift weights and the guys who lift weights with long repetitions, you know, endurance. And the guys who lift just heavy weights, those are the bulky guys. And those bulky guys, that never really works in mixed martial arts. I mean, it takes too much oxygen, you're too slow. You know, there's something working against it. But all the other guys, if their physique looks correct, and they come from a camp like, let's say, a Wanderlei Silva, you know, from Shootbox or some crazy camp where, you know, they train very hard on endurance and power mixed. Yeah, then you can tell. But normally, yeah, I don't look at Petter. I mean, the way he looks, the champ from the UFC right now, how Jan Petter, how he looks. He looks, there's no muscle in there almost. You don't see it. But boy, can he fight. That's an unbelievable. Oh, it is so crazy when you see that guy start hitting. And, you know, all the way back when I worked at Chris Horodesky, right? I remember winning the National Fight League. And, you know, and it was the first time that was his coach, Sean Tompkins, at the time. He said, oh, I'll bring a good guy. And then I saw him. I go, dude, there's a kid. He's like 14 or 15 years old. At least he looks like it. He said, Bucks, just wait. And then he just annihilated, high kicked the guy, knocked him out, you know. And again, you know, you can tell by their body. And actually, a lot of fighters that I know who use a lot of weights, and I always told them, I say, it's so stupid to do that. You know, all that time, if you four times a week are an hour and a half wasting on weights, it's stupid. Use it for weight training that you're actually going to use in the fight. You know, high repetitions, high fast. So at least you do something for the fight. Otherwise, you just do 4 hours a week, there's 16 hours a month, you threw it away. The other guy, he trains fighting 16 hours extra a month. You know, that's a big difference. And I always tell them the example, look at Fedor Emelianenko.
Yeah.
Look at George Barnett. I mean, look at this guy. I mean, he's a freaking animal.
Yeah. He never stops. The guy's got a gas tank that never ends, and he doesn't look. He could look like a very scary looking trucker, you know.
Yeah, so, and he's got that heart also. I remember against he was fighting against Krokop at the Pride Fighting Championships, And you know he was tired because he took the fight. It was an injury. It was he didn't had a lot of way time to train for it, but you know his heart just pulled him through the freaking fight. I mean, he just kept on coming. I go, wow, those fighters I respect a lot who are really tired, but their heart just pulls them through. Like Dan Henderson is one of those guys as well, and Frankie Edgar. You know, guys like that, they never stop, even when they're tired.
Pretty amazing. I did, and also, we can get off Fedor in just a second, although I could talk about him all day as a fighter. But, you know, you mentioned that he knocked out Rodgers and then the Fabricio win. And I, like I said, I was there in person. I was actually there at cage side, and it was like this hushed roar is like the best way I can put it, like this roar of silence. Like it just people could not believe that Fedor just got now. I mean, we'd seen him, you know, remember Fujita knocked him for a good one and, you know, he comes back like 30 seconds later and chokes him out. Randleman, one of your favorites, you know, dumped him on his head and he somehow survived that and got, I mean, do you remember going back to that? Do you remember kind of how you felt at that time thinking, man, that he's going to come out of this and just what was your reaction after, you know, he was done?
You know, it was crazy. I made a comment before when he fought Yoshi Kosaka and he was doing the same thing. He jumped himself and he fell down while he was raining down the ground and pound. Fedor did that. And I said, this is a very dangerous situation against a real good fighter, but they will catch him in a triangle if he does that. That's literally exactly what I said. And then he did it against Verdum and he slept on that triangle. So, but that's Verdum, man. Everybody makes a mistake, you know, and Fedor just made a mistake that evening. It's like you said, you know, to me also, he's one of the greatest of all times. I mean, those losses to me don't count because there was a lot of these losses were past his prime, you know. But when he was in his peak, I mean, the amount of destruction that he did at Fight Fighting Championships, he was just an animal, you know. And then the nicest guy outside it as well, you know. And that just has a really, you know, you're attracted to people like that.
Yeah, yeah. If he was a monster in and out of the cage, I don't think I'd be as big of a fan of his. But yeah, hard to knock him from everything I've heard as far as his character and all that stuff. But yeah, let's jump back into Strikeforce a little bit. You mentioned the heavyweight Grand Prix. That was quite an undertaking, and it was very exciting for me. I was working for Strikeforce at that time, but even as a fan, that was such an exciting thing. What did I've seen just online? I know you did some previews of that and that sort of thing. What did you think of the tournament? Did you think it would work in North America? Were you excited about that? Anybody stick out in your mind as, I don't think anybody had Daniel Cormier picked to win that fight, that tournament at that time. Who was in your mind as the favorite?
Yeah, everybody was talking to me about Daniel Cormier already. They say he's like Cain Velasquez, you know, this is an animal. The guy went to the Olympics. He's a really good wrestler. So I kind of knew that this guy, and like you said, we interviewed him before as well. So I heard about what he did in his past. But still, you know, you never know until you really see it. Yeah, I didn't. I don't know who I had as a favorite. Who were in it again?
Oh man, I know Barnett was in it. I think Croak, because they had some changes around with it. So let me, you know what? As I brought that up, I know I threw you kind of a curveball there. Let me kind of look that up and see what the you know, who it was basically that was in that, because obviously that was a pretty. Oh, you know what? I got it. Here we go. Sorry.
Barnett.
Yeah, Barnett was in it. And oh, you know what, my guy, this is actually a different thing. All right, let me look it up and I'll come back to that, because I do want to get sure
he beat Hari Haritanov. That's what, you know.
Yeah, I think, yeah, Haritanov was in it. I thought Krokop was supposed to be in it and then ended up not being in it. I'm trying to remember going back in my mind who was in it. Coker actually showed me the lineup at the time, but it actually ended up kind of changing. So it's hard to go back to that and try to remember exactly, but, you know, who was.
Yeah,
who was.
I'm pretty sure that I had Barnett as the favorite, you know. Yeah, and there was no way that I thought that Barnett was going to lose to Daniel Cormier. That's what I never.
Yeah, because they ended up being in the final.
Yeah.
Yeah, and Overeem was supposed to be in it, but he ended up not, saying that he was injured at the time, so he was not able. And then Cormier actually replaced Overeem. So that's kind of the hard part about this. There was a lot of changes to it, but yeah, but Cormier ended up beating Bigfoot and then advancing, and Barnett beat Haritanov and ended up advancing, and that's how they got into the final.
Man, I'm talking about Bigfoot and Fedor. Remember that?
Oh yeah,
man, that's crazy. Yeah.
That was just, see, that was a totally different fight for me as far as him versus Fabricio goes. Cause I mean, Bigfoot just beat on him. And that was the first time that I felt like I'd seen him just really getting beat on and me thinking, man, they got to like stop this. Like this isn't, you know, Fedor would take shots for sure. But that one was just, to me, that my memory serves, that was a pretty brutal fight, you know, that.
Yeah.
But anyways,
it was great. It's a spectacle. You see, that's what I mean. Those were the kind of fights that you saw at the Pride Fighting Championships as well. So Gokhar had a lot of that same kind of style.
Yeah, absolutely. And they still, you know, we still see kind of those quote unquote legends fights. We don't see them as much as we used to, but, you know, bringing back Shamrock and Gracie, and, you know, he's done a lot of those types. Tito's, you know, fought obviously several times into his 40s for them. So he does kind of like to bring back the legends and do kind of these as much, you know, obviously they have to be sanctioned and all that stuff. So you're never going to see the, you know, Minowa versus Bob Sapp or, you know, any of those types of fights, at least in a sanctioned event. So, all right. So talking about those a little bit more, do you think, again, they can't really happen in North America because of the commissions and that sort of thing, but in Japan, you can still do those. And I think we still see some of those fights. Is there room in MMA for those circus style fights that Pride popularized? Again, we talked about Sapp versus Jan Norte in this Strikeforce event that, you know, it's almost 700 pounds of well, I don't want to say muscle, but of man in the cage against each other in what was a pretty bad fight. But it was still, again, kind of like one of those, it's going to draw eyeballs because of the circus style, you know, a matchup that it was. Is there room, is there a place for those kind of fights in MMA today, or should we really be sticking to the real straight competitive fights?
No, I think there's room for, as long as people, you know, they have to be realistic. You know, if you get a big, let's say, football player out, you know, and suddenly he fights in a better fight, well, you know, there's probably going to be a slaughter, and you know, it's as long as they're the same weight. Like, they can never put fights on like they did in Japan. Like you said, Minima fights a guy who's fucking 300 pounds heavier than him. You know, you can't do that here in America because there's rules here, you know, but as long as the guys are at least in the same shape and the Athletic Commission approves it, I'm okay for it. I just don't think it's good to constantly do it, but here and there, I always enjoy a fight like that.
Okay, yeah, which I agree with you. I did like those for, you know, when like Hongman Choi fought Fedor, you know, 7-2 versus like 5-11 or whatever. I mean, it's just interesting. You know, it's interesting. But on flip side, those fights almost never actually pan out into really good fights, you know? Yeah. So that's kind of the tough part of it. Go ahead.
For the first time we saw Bob Sapp against Nogueira, I thought Bob Sapp did a phenomenal job. I mean, he survived like 9 minutes or something. I don't remember anymore the time. We were there. It was that Dynamite show, the open air, 91,500 people. And I go, man, we're going to hear a lot from Bob Sapp. But then Bob, I think, got more attracted. They put him in so many things, like eclipse and in interviews and constantly. And it really was hurting his training. And because the first fight, I mean, what you remember, he pile-drived Nogueira into the ground. We were in the cemetery. I thought, we have our first death here now.
Right.
Driving up the pile-up with his body weight. And Nogueira, just like Fedor, you know, doesn't give a crap. And 2 minutes later, got him in an armbar. You know, I mean, that was cool stuff. So I thought we were going to hear from him a lot. And then especially after a host, when he beat the Nesto host. How did he beat him? Well, he actually beat him twice. Twice?
Yeah.
The one time he hit him just on his gloves, and the own gloves for the host cut his own eyes. And then they stopped the fight. You know, but it was freaking the Nesto host.
Yeah,
you know,
Mr. Perfect.
He was the guide. I went out to dinner with him one time in Japan because I was training him He had 10 days training with me, but one day he was there was for the fight against the Mirko Krokop. And I told him, I said, don't do these interviews, man. Krokop has a picture of you on his boxing bag. You're going to have a problem. You know, this guy is a murderer. You know? But he had to do all these interviews and all that stuff. But anyway, we were eating at the restaurant. And I remember two people at the front window, they saw him and they stopped. And that became, if I say there were like 150 people outside, I'm not even exaggerating. We had to leave the back door. They had to let us out because one person would see him. You could not walk on the street with Bob Sapp. Everybody knew that guy.
You mentioned Krokop. You remember when they fought in kickboxing I'm sure you remember the end of that fight because it's your favorite, your signature call, the liver shot. He got that left liver shot in and Sapp just like crumpled and, you know, fell to the mat and that was it. But Sapp, like, he's one of, and you know, no disrespect to him as a person. I don't know him obviously, but I just felt like, especially later on, because he had a 9-2 record. We're talking about this. He headlined the Strikeforce fight, his only Strikeforce event that he ever did. It was his North American MMA debut. He just folds in like 55 seconds. And that was the beginning of really of the end of him as a real viable MMA fighter. And it just seemed like he just gave up. Like it seemed like any type of adversity in the ring or the cage, and he would just fold. And I just really came to just not have much respect for him as a fighter. And maybe it was all the interviews. And I mean, like you said, he was an absolute mega star in Japan. I mean, he had, he cut a music album in Japan. I don't know if it was any good, but he actually made an album. So, I mean, he was a massive, massive star. So it sounds like that's what got to him, but I just, it's hard for me to really find a lot of respect for somebody that just kind of gives up, you know?
Yeah, no, for me too. And talking about the star, I remember his high school book, you know, with all the pictures in it from the whole high school. They sold
the yearbook.
$25,000 in Japan.
My God.
Dude, if I would have known that, I would have let go to a printer, print like 50 of them. They sell it for only $10,000.
Capitalism at its finest. All right. Well, I want to ask you a couple, just based on your involvement with MMA as a coach and then as a kind of a color commentator, if a fighter could master only one martial art in today's MMA, you know, I know you used to talk about in Pride that I believe that you thought wrestling was probably the best base to have, but if, and you can correct me if I'm wrong on that, my memory may be wrong on that, but what if in today's MMA world, if you could only train one martial art to be really especially proficient at, which one do you think would be the most important?
It's a hard question, because what I always said in Pride is wrestling is the glue that holds everything together. So you're either a really good striker and a good wrestler, or you're a really good ground fighter and a good wrestler. So now if I have to make a choice to one, I'm looking at guys like Damian Maia, and I'm saying I go with Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. The only reason I'm saying that is, but they need to have good takedowns, of course.
Yeah.
Because if you cannot take it to the ground, if you're fighting a wrestler, but you see, if you just fight a wrestler, that's good. But a wrestler with hands, but then again, that is two styles combined. You see what I mean? So
yeah.
So it's very hard to leave the wrestling out, because you need that. And trust me, in my career, I never had the wrestling. I sucked as a wrestler.
Right.
You know, and I always said that. I said, but you know, it was really cool because I had a whole bunch of submissions, but I was never, I never took anybody down. So I just made sure that I was really good on the ground. And then if something would come in and reverses and submissions, but wrestling, yeah. And also maybe back in my head, you know, most of the time when people hurt their knees, are blasting their knees in training, it's always with the wrestling, you know, and there's a lot of injuries coming from that. So maybe that's why I stayed away from it. I have no clue. But yeah, so I would say if he's got good takedowns, but that will be wrestling. But as a jiu-jitsu guy, a really good takedowns, well, then I would say jiu-jitsu, because, you know, if you can take your fighter to the ground, he can be Mike Tyson, that it's going to have a problem. And again, look at Damian Maia, what he's doing.
Yeah. Hey, you brought up Tyson. That nothing to do with MMA, but are you in any way excited about the Roy Jones fight? Is that you planning on plunking down some cash for that, or is not something you're interested in?
No, I'm super interested. I've been a few times at his workouts, and man, he's still a scary guy. You know, my whole fighting style, my you know, the way I rotate the body and everything, that is completely from Tyson and Roman Deckers, you know, the greatest Thai boxer ever, I believe. Mm-hmm. And then pound for pound. And then Mike Tyson is the hardest puncher also. And questionably also the best boxer ever, you know, especially when he was in his prime. So, you know, I always love that. And the way he can contract his core to twist his upper body. I always tell my students this, you know, he can give you a left uppercut, left hook, and a liver shot. There's like three lefts in a row. And you hear pop, pop, pop. And then when you slow-mo it, he will load up for every single strike. And he found a way to contract his core muscles so explosively. Yeah, that's why he's got that incredible power. So, yeah, no, I'm a huge Mike Tyson fan. Also a good guy outside of fighting, you know, the way he talks. He's so honest, you know, and he's so real when you talk to a guy like that. I just love it.
I've listened to his last two interviews on when he's been on Rogan's podcast, and he was on – right before they announced that, you know, you started seeing, he was training with Cordero from Shootbox. And, you know, once before those hit, he was on and he was kind of talking about feeling kind of the itch a little bit. And then he's back on a couple months ago when he was full on in training, and Rogan was talking about just the incredible difference. And he's like, you're like a caged animal, you know, right now, like now that he's in training. So you said you've been in some of his training sessions. Are you saying for the Jones fight, or do you mean in the past?
No, for the Jones fight.
Okay. Obviously you can do things with video, and you know, there's a difference between hitting mitts and really, you know, getting in there.
Yeah.
Is he looking like, let's say Tyson was a 10. All right. In comparison at his height, in comparison to Tyson at his height as a 10, where would you say he's at right now, just based on what you've seen in the training?
Well, you know, that's a weird thing. I will be a 7 or an 8, but I mean, a 7 or an 8 will
a 7 or 8 Tyson is still a monster.
Yeah. But I mean, we're talking about a guy who has perfect technique. I mean, you can slow-mo it down. His straight punches are perfect straight. Everything is, you know, Gus D'Amato did a really good thing with him. He just ingrained it immensely. And so yeah, he's so perfect. Like I said, he can win a world title being a 5. See what I mean? So I would, of course, need to say we need to see what endurance does and everything. But listen, in training, everything looks great. I'm always wondering, my head is always, you know, fight day again. That's the whole thing.
Yeah.
Is he come back to that animal? Because yeah, we all can look good in training. I remember Ronda Rousey. I saw her doing a warm-up in Brazil. She won that fight, actually, but she was warming up on the focus mat. And I said, well, that was nearly perfect. And I'm a very critical guy. But I said right away, that is on the focus mitts. You know, this is not an opponent hitting back. You know, so that's a different story. Now, I've seen him spar also. So, I think he's going to be just fine.
I one more Tyson question, then I'll let it go. Do you, we're talking about circus fights and all that stuff. You think there's a possibility he comes out and just destroys Jones, and then, you know, we start, you know, Anthony Joshua or, you know, Fury or, you know, one of those guys. Is there a chance we see the unbelievable dream, you know, the Rocky scenario, and him actually fight for another heavyweight title, in your opinion?
Well, you know, they always say the first thing that goes is speed, right? I've seen some fighters who were getting up in age and who were past like 50 years old, and then they're hitting the focus mitts and come for, and they were telling people they wanted to come for a comeback. And then I see them hitting the focus mitts and I go, you should not come back. This is good right now. You know, it sucks. You know, that unfortunately that is. Tyson doesn't seem to lose anything. So I don't know. I mean, you know, and it's not because I'm in awe of him already, but it's just like, you know, he's just still fast. And power, we all know power, you don't lose.
It's the last thing you go.
It's the last thing you lose. So the speed and the power, it will be there. So yeah, I think, and Roy Jones, I mean, it's not going to be an easy fight. People go like, oh, Mike Tyson, but Roy Jones, he's got some footwork. He's going to stay on the outside, going to try to pick him apart, you know? So, you know, if he beats Roy Jones, I think that's a really good one. And then, yeah, knowing him, I mean, I just put myself in his shoes. So what would I do? Well, if I would knock out Roy Jones, and very convincing, and hopefully like in the third round, and have 2 or 3 dominated rounds, and then in the third round, not in the first round, one punch is knockout, because they still don't know anything, you know. But then for sure, if I would have that myself, yeah, I would go right away for the champions. I mean, let's see if we can make that crazy American dream become reality.
That'd be the biggest heavyweight fight, money wise. That would have to be the biggest heavyweight fight that they could possibly make, is him versus, you know, Fury or Joshua. So, but that'd be insane. Yeah.
This point, I wonder how many people are going to buy it, because I'm buying it. You know, everybody knows Tyson. Think about that. I mean, you know, any country, every person knows who Mike Tyson is. So there's a lot of people going to watch this.
Yeah. I think it's going to be very interesting to see what happens. And then it would be very interesting to see a 5'10 dynamo taking on a 7-footer like Fury, or Josh was like 6'7" or something like that. So it'd be a little bit different to see him take on somebody that's got so much reach on him, but you know, he was usually the shorter fighter. So it'd be interesting. All right. So I did want to ask a couple questions about you as a color commentator. What does it take to be an effective color commentator? I mean, for me, it's great if you're a former fighter, because you can insert things that the play-by-play man is just not going to really pick up on. Is that really important to you? Do you need that? Kind of what for you, what makes somebody effective on color commentary?
You know, so many commentators, before they start commentating, would call me and they say, hey, boss, what is the trick? And I never, you know, what I always said was this. It's very simple. Treat the people at home as a white belt. Because yes, you will, your friends are watching and they know what to do, but guess what? 95% of the people who are watching never been in a training. You know, they never worked out. And you have to teach him. If you say we're wrestling, oh, run the pipe, you know, he's running the pipe. You know, oh, what the frick is running the pipe? You know, explain to people at home what things are, you know. And I think that helps a lot, because the most great comments that I always got is, man, while I listen to you, I learned so much about the sport. And that's literally what I'm doing. That's what I'm just teaching. And I consider everybody being a white belt. Too bad for the people who at home say, oh, yeah, that's logic that he does that. But again, that is maybe 5% of the people who are watching. So that's what I always did. And apparently it worked.
Yeah. You're definitely top one or two as far as color commentators go, in my opinion. But you also have to have a good partner. You've worked with some greats on commentary, the Fight Professor, Mauro. You know, you've worked with some really great guys, Kenny Rice. Who's your favorite, or who you? I don't say who's your favorite because I don't want to put you in that position. But who's the best comment, whether you worked with them or not? Who's the best in MMA history, in your opinion?
Well, that's a hard one. I think Mauro, and I'm saying this because Mauro started seeing submission things, because he was watching the DVDs that I gave him, everything about instructionals. And Mauro is a workhorse. Mauro is never happy with his last show. There's always room for improvement. Mauro is always rehearsing. You know, Mauro, when you see him read a script, he's always moving his mouth. So it's everything he does is towards commentating. He is so invested. When people say, oh, he's fake, those are BS people. They're really dumb people. They don't even know who he is. This guy, I mean, he's in his own complete bubble. And everything, he loves it, he thrives it, like the pro wrestling. And I all said this, but the pro wrestling also, you know, he had to do one show. And I said, whoa, wait, stop. And it wasn't a set of X's MMA. I said, you're going to do one show, you're going to do X's TV, pro wrestling? Yeah, I said, WWE is going to call you within 2 months, and you're going to be their announcer. And everybody was laughing. I said, mark my words. And sure enough, they heard him. You know, Mauro is one of these guys. He's all, it's like a crazy memory. Like Kenny Rice is a crazy memory as well. You know, you talk to him, and those are guys, when you do an opening of the show, they will never mess up. I mean, prompter readings, all this stuff. I mean, they edit it. They've never seen the whole piece on the prompter. And while they're going through it, they're already editing it live. I mean, who can do that? You know, yeah. I can't do that. You know, and for instance, Stephen Quarters, he had a great memory with all fights. You would tell him, say, oh, when fought so-and-so. So Pele against somebody. Oh, that was that day, this day, boom, boom, boom. And then, you know, so everybody was on that card. You see, he had a great memory. So everybody has their own things. But Mauro is always, when he goes into something, it's the only thing he does. And he never takes things for granted. And he only wants to be better. He's like learning. His vocabulary is just bizarre. Oh. I mean, he learns every day a new word, you know. And he's been doing that for years. This guy, yeah, it's something. But then again, you know, I worked intensely great with Kenny. Kenny was also one of those guys that, you know, he didn't know anything about mixed martial arts when he came into the International Fight League. Nobody noticed the thing, because the way he does it and bring it, and he does his homework, you know, he's just very invested as well.
Yeah, I mean, all those guys are great. I'm not super familiar with Kenny's commentary because I just haven't watched a lot of promotions that he called, but the Strikeforce event that I just mentioned was the first Strikeforce event that he called alongside Frank Trigg. And I was really impressed. I thought he did a really fantastic job. And I know that was early on in him getting involved in MMA, which makes it even more impressive. So I agree with you on that. But for me, it's got to be Mauro. I think he's the greatest of all time, simply for the fact that whether it's pro wrestling, it's MMA, it's boxing, it's kickboxing, he does it all fantastically. And I think he's amazing. Yes, some people may say he's over the top and it comes across as inauthentic. I actually worked with him through Frank Shamrock for a little while, and I got to know him a little bit. That is who he is. Like, that's, yep. It's completely authentic. And so for somebody that, you know, has watched him for a long time and all that stuff, like, he's the greatest all around, for sure.
Yeah. So. I'm so proud that I put him in the business, you know, because I met him in Vancouver when I was shooting a show. Holt McCallany, the guy, the lead actor from Mindhunter, he was having a TV show at the time, Freedom called, from Joe Silver. And I was his fight choreographer, and I lived there for 7 months, and they found out I was there, and they had this Z movie, you know, where we had to do commentating for, and they ended Mauro. And Mauro was really overweight at the time. And I met Mauro, but he started talking. I remember I had a 6-page script. And I was going through it. And Mauro showed up a little late, and he literally reads the script six pages, does it maybe three times. So I'm talking about 3 minutes, maybe 4 minutes, and he puts it away, say, let's go. I go, you're serious, dude? I say, what? I said, you have it? And so I start throwing the lines with him, and he had every single line. And I go, dude, this is insanity. So then we start working together, and we just clicked. We were commentators in that movie together. And we clicked right away. So after the show, I said to him, I said, hey, give me your number, because you never know. Maybe something happens in the future, because you should be in commentating, dude. This is show. Yeah, I always wanted to do it. I did pro wrestling, and he told me the whole thing. So 4 years later, they got rid of Steven Quaros. I didn't want to put him on right away, because Steven is a friend of mine also. And I thought maybe he's going to think I replaced him with Mauro. And I didn't know, just didn't want to have the feeling. So they got that Damon Perry guy, but didn't work because he had a one-man radio show. And, well, I literally had to put my hand on his mouth during the show to make him shut up. Because I saw a submission coming, and he just keeps on talking, you know. So, like, it's so crazy. But anyway, then I said, yeah, I think I have a guy, but I don't know if his number still works. And I left him a message. And he came just out of the crazy house. He was 2 months inside. He had a real bad episode of his bipolar
disorder.
Disorder. And his mother told him it's on the machine. So it's this weird guy with a weird accent. That was me. And he listened to it. I said, Mauro, this is me. You got to send in a tape to Power Fighting Championship. Boom. And they saw the tape, immediately got him. And after the first show, I remember we were sitting, and I, Mauro, you understand this, right? You're going to be the best commentator on the planet. I guarantee you, the 1st December is coming up. You're going to be the best commentator. Sure enough, 1st December, he was the number one play-by-play guy. You know, so, yeah, super stoked that I had to. And he's always, at the time, like the first 8-9 years after that, he would call me crying every New Year's. Thank you, Miles. And I go, Mauro, if you would have sucked, I could have never done this, you know? You were just passed it on, you know, because your talent needed to be seen. So, very, very happy with that. I was right with that one.
Mauro is just fantastic, and it's still great. I heard him on – he commentated one of the boxing events over the – as we record this over this last weekend. So, I know he's still working and all that stuff. So, just it was great to hear him. So, yeah.
Yep.
All right. Well, you've given us so much time, and I really appreciate it. I wanted to ask one more question, but before we do that, I know you have your hands, as we mentioned at the top of the show, you have your hands in a lot of different pies. Anything you want to mention as far as your involvement today that you want to push out there to the listeners?
You know, I'm so stoked about my O2 trainers, a lung training device I came up with when I was 14 years old. And I started making it about 10 years ago. And this thing, what it's doing right now, the doctors, pulmonologists, the people who treat COPD and asthma patients, you know, they're actually getting it from insurance now to buy. I mean, it's doing really great things. And endurance for athletes. My endurance is now the best that it's ever been. I would say better. I'm 55 years old. I train twice a week stamina. It's just crazy what it does. It trains your breathing muscles. And you cannot train those breathing muscles. We all have about 10 pounds of breathing muscles that people simply don't know of. They train everything else, but they don't train those muscles. And I won't go too deep into it, but this thing right now is doing so well. And I'm so happy because the amount of people that I'm helping with it. I knew COPD and asthma, that was going to be it, because my asthma disappeared within 3 weeks. And I was a severe asthma patient. You have to understand, I carried an inhaler with me everywhere I went. All my fights, I needed an inhaler in the dressing room, every single fight of me. So now suddenly, after 3 weeks doing that, suddenly don't use an inhaler anymore. That was an eye opener for me. Sent one to my friend in Holland. He has asthma. 8 days later, he called me. True story, 100%. You can look everything up. And he said, I want to sell him here. I said, what's going on? He says, my asthma's gone. I go, dude, we're onto something, you know? And then I got a connection with the guy who trades 4 Olympic gold medalists. And suddenly they realized they were doing it. And now I got published medical journals to back everything up. And boom, the things start catching fire. And I think people should really look into it.
Okay. And that's available on, I'm actually looking at your website right now. So bossrootin.com, right in the middle, it says O2 trainer at the top. So listeners can check that out. I know that they can also check you out on Instagram, at Boss Rootin MMA, and then on Twitter, same thing, at Boss Rootin MMA. But yeah, so listeners, make sure you go check that out. Make sure you follow him on Twitter and Instagram. Finally, I want to ask you one final question. We'll let you go. In your opinion, what is Strikeforce's place in MMA history?
Oof.
I know that's a big one, and I know it's kind of broad, but kind of where do you put them as, you know, 1-2 with the UFC, a little lower? Do you kind of, where do you place them as far as their importance, their influence on MMA?
Well, at the time, did the UFC have 18,000 people at that time? when where was that actually? Oh, at the time it was. Where was that?
It was in San Jose. It was their very first event. It was in San Jose.
And what year was that? Was it
2006.
Six. Okay, that was just when the UFC started getting big, right? That was the Ultimate
Fighter. It was. Yeah, they're coming off the Ultimate Fighter. They're on a real roll at that point.
They're you know what? They're in the MMA Pioneers Hall of Fame, shall we say, from all
there you go.
You know,
there you go.
Because 100% they have to be in there because he made a big mark. You know, look at it. I mean, UFC bought Strikeforce. I mean, because it was just that great of a show. Now you see him again in Bellator. You know, Scott is just a really smart guy. He was already, you know, he's kickboxing, everything. Way before that, I think he started in 86.
Yeah, he started in like the mid 80s. He got to do some point karate like on ESPN and just got, we actually interviewed him for our first episode of the podcast and he kind of dove into all that. But yeah, amazing guy. Absolutely. Yep.
So yeah, so he needs to be mentioned. That's 100% certain.
Well, we'll see if that ever get if Tito can get into the UFC Hall of Fame, I think anybody can get into regardless of their relationship with Dana. So I guess we'll see if that ever happens with Scott. Probably a long shot, but we'll see. But boss, I really, really appreciate you taking the time to be on the show with us today. It was great. We went into a bunch of areas that I wasn't sure if we would we delve. I never thought we'd be talking about Tyson and we did, but it was great. And boss, thank you for taking the time today.
You're very welcome, man. It was nice. A memory down to memory lane, right? We talked about things in the past again. To relive these moments, it's always cool.
All right, I want to thank my very special guest, El Wapo, Boss Rutan. I appreciate him taking the time to join us for this episode, this bonus episode. Hope that you enjoyed it as well. As we record this, the U.S. presidential election is still undecided, so hopefully this was a bit of a respite for you. But I really enjoyed talking with Boss, getting his thoughts on Strikeforce and Fedor and Bob Sapp and Mike Tyson and all that. It was really great for me personally to be able to connect with him and talk with him. He's somebody I've wanted to have on the show for a while, and I'm glad that we were able to make that happen. And again, I hope that you've enjoyed that. Hope that you have also subscribed to the show, because coming up in just a few days, we are going to be dropping one of our regularly scheduled episodes. It is a conversation with Gorgeous George Garcia of MMA Junkie Radio, one of the OGs of MMA journalism, of MMA radio, and he's taking the time to talk with us, and he shares some really cool stories. We talk about Strikeforce's talent influence on the UFC and Bellator. George talks about when he found out about Strikeforce being acquired by UFC and going back even earlier to the Playboy Mansion show. He was there in person. So it's a really, really good conversation. I again, love talking with George anytime that I get the chance. And this was a good one. So hopefully you are ready for that. Hopefully you have followed us on Twitter and on Instagram at Inside the Hexagon Pod. You can also reach me at phil@insidethehexagon.com. But with that, we're going to go ahead and ride off into the sunset. Hope that you're staying safe and you stay healthy. And we'll see you soon.
Hi, this is comedian and writer, and let's be honest, I do a lot of things. This is Dean Archipotis, the host of Whiskey Business, the podcast not so much about whiskey as it is one with whiskey. Yes, we drink and talk about whiskey, but we do so much more with so many interesting people. For example, we talk to comedians like Greg Warren.
You know, I don't want to brag, but let's just say I can walk into a Red Lobster and get whatever. You know, I think the pause right there is probably more important than the word.
Amazing athletes like boxing champion Buster Douglas.
When a fighter's down and he's looking for his mouthpiece instead of trying to get up.
That's when I knew it was over.
Yeah, right?
And yes, Bigfoot chasers.
Do you believe in Bigfoot? And if so, does he really eat beef jerky?
The Bigfoot thing is people have seen these, and I've seen a lot of compelling evidence about it.
It's Whiskey Business with Dean Archipotis. Join us for what we call a good conversation with a good pour. You really can't ask for much more than that, can you, people? Check us out at WhiskeyBusinessPod.com, a proud member of the Evergreen Podcast Network.